Hi, everyone, and welcome to another Building Better Futures for Health podcast. I'm your host and Executive Director of IDE, Richard Sokolov. Today, we have a panel of two esteemed academics now commercializing a very novel sexual health product, one of many to come, I hope, and kicking some significant goals along the way. And my goal today is to get some insights into their journey from academia to entrepreneurship so that we can share that with everyone who's listening and watching, and we can all learn from it. So both of my guests are co-founders of Udemon. I hope I pronounced that right, guys. And let me just briefly intro Udemon, and then we'll get on to the two of you.
Oh, it's Udemon.
Udemon, okay. Udemon. It took me a while. Still can't get it right, but that's okay. Udemon is a disruptive, rapid platform product innovation engine with a focus on sexual and reproductive health and wellness. Formed in 2019, Udemon has a focus to provide superior sexual reproductive health and wellness products to every person for every situation. You are bridging internal and partner-based next-generation capabilities in advanced manufacturing, material science, and human-centered design to deliver benefits to consumers, manufacturers, brands, and health agencies. So that's what Udemon's all about. Our two guests, the first, let's start with you, Rob. You're the CEO and co-founder of Udemon. You have a PhD in biomedical engineering. You're a former university lecturer at University of Wollongong, or professor, I should say, and I still think you're doing some work in academia. So thank you for joining us.
Oh, happy to be here.
And next to you is your mate and co-founder, Simon Cook, Dr. Simon Cook, also a PhD. You're the CTO of Udemon. Yeah. You have a PhD in biochemistry. You're a Fulbright Future Scholar and a former adjunct senior research fellow at Swinburne University. Of technology, I should say. Your bios are very long, so that's very short. Yeah. So I was just saying, welcome.
Thank you very much.
You can tell the story going on. Yes. Thanks, guys, for joining us. It's excellent. We've been working together now for a while, so we know
each
other.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having us.
No, it's great to have you. There's a third co-founder who's not with us today, Nick. So that's because he lives on the other side of Australia, so couldn't get him here in person. So shout out to Nick if he's watching and listening. Hopefully he will. But yeah, so maybe we'll just get straight into how you got here. So you guys both had extensive backgrounds in academia. I was doing the research for this podcast. It was like quite difficult to get through everything. And it was done globally. So the US, Ireland, Korea, you guys have been all around the world. Obviously done a lot of your work here in Australia. Can you both take us on a brief journey of how you got to where you are today? I don't know, whoever wants to go first can go first.
I can go first. So when I met Rob, essentially. So
Right.
My... My career trajectory is a little bit shorter because I did my PhD, I did my undergrad and my PhD at the University of Wollongong. Mm-hmm. So I was finishing up my PhD in 2014. And to get to this point now, I was literally walking down the corridor and my PhD supervisor at the time tapped me on the shoulder and said, "You're looking for a postdoc or a job, aren't you? You want to work on condoms?" I was like, what? That's sort of a question typically get asked. I didn't know if I had to take him to HR or whatnot, but yeah. I said, "Yeah, let's. What is it? What are we doing?"
Yeah.
And so that's where I got introduced to Rob. And so that was back 2014. Mm. So from there, I was finishing up my PhD. I was very happy to stay in academia. I was very happy to stay in the field that I was in, working on Group A Streptococcus. I was going to go look for jobs. Mm. My now fiance was finishing up her PhD, so I was going to be around for another year looking for work before we made a move.
Yeah.
Could have been anywhere, really, and just got offered this to work on this project. And so from there, when Rob got this, well, we applied for this grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, I started on the project really from using my microbiology skills. So we didn't know if the materials would let bacteria or viruses through, and that's very important for a condom, right? Mm. So I started working on the project then. And the short story from there is that we had $100,000 from the Gates Foundation. Mm. I'll let Rob tell the genesis of the Gates Foundation stuff.
Yeah. But we'll get to that one.
We had this small pool of money that we could go and you could apply for a second round, phase two funding from the Gates Foundation was $1 million. So we did all this work. I think Rob can go through a whole bunch of the stuff that we did that year, but at the end of it, we reapplied and Rob and I formed a very good team just then. Mm. We wrote the majority of that grant that went in for the phase two. Mm. And when we put that in, contract was finished up. The money was done with that. We'd partnered with Swinburne University. My fiance had finished her PhD and I was like, well, I think I'm going to move to Melbourne.
Right.
So then I moved down to Melbourne. But fortunately, we were working with Swinburne Uni. While I waited for the outcome of the Gates Foundation grant, you know, I was down there just going for jobs, like went for a couple of jobs. And I realized, you know, if I take a job somewhere else, I'm never going to be able to come back and work on this again.
Right.
So I waited and waited and waited. The Gates Foundation are a bit slow assessing their grants. And it took about maybe 5 to 6 months. And they got us back. And so I was leading the project at Wollongong, at Swinburne, rather, and Rob was taking on the side from Wollongong. And that's how we formed this kind of like academic team, partner between two universities. And we realized at some point, as we were leading the whole development of the condom, which goes across neuroscience, material science, user-driven design, the manufacturing, all these things that tie together, we realized we need to commercialize it. And, you know, the only vehicle to do that is our own startup company.
Yeah, and here you are.
And here we are.
Maybe we pivot to Rob.
Yeah, for sure.
And we'll come back to that because I think we haven't introduced what it is, but obviously people know now it's a condom. But it's not just that. I think it's a platform for a lot more things. But
absolutely.
Rob, your background, how you got into academia, how you got to here, and then let's unpack that first, and then we'll get into a bit of the Udemy technology.
Yeah, okay. All right, where to start? So maybe desperation? It was probably the beginning in, you know, my academic career.
Why you went to academia?
I started off in engineering physics during my undergrad. And you can tell from my accent, I'm from the States. So I was in Pittsburgh, really kind of setting myself up to work in the semiconductor industry and started playing around with putting cells on chips, kind of made a move to Merck Pharmaceuticals for a little bit. And then, all right, well, if I want a career into the next step, really, those people that were there had PhDs. They were running the lab. So went back, did my PhD out at University of California, Irvine. And then between there and here, it was, India, South Korea, Malaysia, Ireland, and then here.
Mm.
And a lot of the times it was, you know, I wasn't focused on sexual and reproductive health from the beginning, doing clinical diagnostics and other very interesting biomedical engineering related projects. A lot of times on the interface of academia and industry is quite different, but my interests were very varied and projects changed quite often and often because of money. You know, funding would run out.
Yeah, where it runs out, you got to find somewhere else to get money from and try something else, right?
2 years into my PhD, my boss came and said, look, the project's changed. Either you find your own money or you go to India for 6 months. So it was great experiences and fantastic. I say that with a desperation, but it was a very, very good experience.
Yeah.
Coming to Australia, started working in bioprinting at the University of Wollongong and was really making next generation. Well, I was working on some of the equipment that was doing a lot of interesting stuff for 3D printing organs and prosthetics. And then the Gates Foundation came around and said, well, we're looking for an innovation in the condoms. And then that kind of kicked that off.
Right. So it was just like an opportunity. Someone had a bit of a problem. What was the specifics of what they were looking for?
Yeah. Well, I'll say first before going into that I was – when I came to Australia, from a personal perspective, I was considering it my last hurrah.
Oh, really?
In academia.
Right. Why is that?
Well, during even my PhD, it started a little bit of entrepreneurship, had been exposed to a few things.
Itchy feet or something?
Yeah, and I was seeing even my area kind of being not a self-fulfilling kind of potential, but it was not making the impact that I wanted to see. So I didn't know about bioprinting when I came to Australia. So it was a really interesting new thing, but I didn't plan on staying in it. And then, the opportunity to work with the Gates Foundation came around. I'd always been interested in what they were doing. And look, we were playing with materials that felt more tissue-like or more skin-like. Right. And when I said, we need new innovations that are going to be game changing in the sexual health and particularly in the condom ecosystem. And so I was like, well, look, we have these good materials that are working for these other things. Can we just replace latex and make a better feeling condom? And that really kicked off the whole.
That program part. From Gates is awesome. It was a Grand Global Challenges scheme. And it's where they invested money into things that hadn't been innovated in for years or decades. And so they put small seed pools of funding, small for Gates levels. they're reasonable. They get the job done. But they put out these calls and they put it out for, you know, it can be multitudes of things, a lot of things in things that can promote health and wellness in the developing world, and condoms are one of those. They put out a call asking for a better feeling condom that can promote uptake and use to promote use in to reduce STIs and promote family planning in the developing
world. That's one thing.
That was the call.
Yeah, obviously preparing for today, I was thinking about, you know, when you think about innovation, especially in sexual health and STIs, you think vaccines, you think therapies, you don't think condoms, right? You don't think as that's the most place where there's innovation. I mean, it's a one part thing. They've been around for decades, if not centuries, in some other form.
I never thought I'd be sitting here talking to you about condoms or working on condoms.
So yeah, so it's really interesting. So it was just that it's almost like a little bit of a crossover between what you're doing, this opportunity with Gates. You saw some sort of synergies, and it just started because we met way back in 2016, I think.
Yeah, there was the extension of some of the work, and probably just a little bit more on the Gates side. So they were, they fund things across. It's everything. Well, at the time, they were looking at really, how can we improve the lives of people, particularly in Southeast Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa? And sexual and reproductive health is obviously a huge part of that. I don't think that the Gates Foundation really actually cared about condoms, but they care about the outcomes of not using the condoms, which is the sexual transmitted diseases and unplanned pregnancies and everything else. And you're right, it's a legacy issue, you know, not much innovation in decades, if not half a century, that they were seeding all types of projects. We were one of 1,700 applicants for ideas. And it was everything from new condom materials to new condom education to new deployment to whatever.
Slingshot condom.
Yeah.
All kinds of random ideas.
It was good timing and a good challenge. And, you know, in the beginning when I did talk to some of the material scientists, you know, they first laughed. We don't do this. And they're like, well, you know, actually these materials are approaching rubber. So you may have a shot.
Shot in this. Because I remember when we met, I think for people listening, you guys were one of the winners of our very first BBFH program. You were the People's Choice. And I remember meeting you. You had shorter hair back then, Rob.
Some had longer hair.
Yes.
Maybe.
That's right. But, and I remember you bringing the material and feeling it, and you were so passionate about it. I'm going, oh, what's this guy talking about? And then you were so passionate about it. You showed me the material. I go, okay, this is really interesting. And sort of percolated for a while, right? And then you got this grant. But maybe if we take you back to that year, what was the goal back then? So I know you had, you talk about how it sort of started, and it's really great. We've got the Genesis story there. But at that moment, what goal did you have? Because I know that things have evolved quite dramatically since then, right?
Right. And it also is interrelated to, you know, our relationship in IDE. So look, at the time, we'll go back even a little bit further. So we got some Gates funding, initial kind of seed funding, and then we were fortunate enough and showed promise enough to get phase two funding, which was another $1 million from them. And it was really taking this, what was really just a very rough idea, and trying to kind of showcase that the concept could actually be realistic. So with condoms being medical devices having all sorts of ISO standards and everything else, you know, we're doing stuff in academia, but it was always a realization that at one point it was going to need to go to the next level. And where was that appropriate wasn't to be seen. We thought industry would be the first kind of players to take it up. As part of that process, even when we first got that funding, while there was a research agenda, there was also this concept that, look, we need to build the program around this. And so I was actually doing my MBA at the time and was participating in the medical device commercialization training program from New South Wales Health.
Yep. New South Wales Health and Sakata.
And one of your previous employees came in and was one of the primary ecosystem builders. He was showcasing, you know, here's what we do. You know, we work on ISO 13485 compliance and medical device development, and we assist in this. And it was really at that point that we already knew, doing kind of call it business development or project development, that beyond just showing that, look, let's take some consumers and try to get some insights that they will potentially like this if it could ever get out there. How do you go through that whole process of getting the medical device to market? So we had that conversation, and part of that was also, hey, you should pitch at this
BBFH.
And so we were at the point of looking for all opportunities. And I will say the cash was definitely an incentive, but also we had talked to you guys about working together, and it was really what could we do. It was early stage, but we had some goals in terms of taking our process of making the condoms in the lab and translating that into some sort of minimum industry level. And I say that very small level, just in an R&D sense, but something that was realistic or could be a stepping stone to moving forward. And that the goal there, the goal of being at the BBFH was really to help to secure some of that bit, because that was a huge question. It was the Gates Foundation funded things about show us people like it. They weren't funding us on, okay, once it gets there, how are you going to get it to market? How are you going to get it to everyone? So we knew that that was going to be a gap, and we were going to be approaching that at that point.
Yeah, because people don't realize, actually, you see a condom, you think it's just one thing. And what's really, but there's a lot behind it, is what I'm trying to say. And when we're working together, it's a project of the actual condom itself, but it's also a project to create the automation systems that we've done with you to build them. And we've made a second one now that we're piloting that and moving that along. You guys are nonstop producing and refining your condom. So yeah, people don't, I think when you think, and my eyes open up as well, right? When you guys first walked in the door, I'm going, okay, well, what's this all about? And then you start to realize, actually, there's not any innovation in the hydrogel technology, and we're talking about its other capabilities, not just making it feel good, but there's a whole archaic almost industry in how they make latex condoms now that was sort of ripe for innovation to do things better and cheaper and with
still
more effects.
Is.
Yeah, it still is, right? That's where we're trying to go.
I don't think Rob and I, to be honest, even knew the level of complexity and detail you'd have to go into to get a condom to market. Yeah. And it's like right from the start, I think one of the things that IDEA would call is like an XFT, a cross-functional team. And that's what like Rob had the vision of building at the start, right? It's like you need to put all these pieces in place to help you try to succeed. And so at the start, like even between the universities, like at Wollongong and Swinburne, it was a team of like, we had close to 20, 30 people working on at the universities, which was awesome and all great, fantastic researchers that all did their bit through material science, microbiology, neuroscience, the human-centered design, some of the branding, manufacturing, branding, messaging. Exactly, and it's like, well, how do you, when you start building that out, you're like, holy hell, this is complicated. But you need all those bits to drive it all together to go somewhere. And when we have these cross-functional teams and multidisciplinary levels of working together, which is awesome, it also breeds a lot of serendipity that comes into the project. And I think the BBFH was a serendipitous event because, you know, it was a prize pool, People's Choice, and it ended up formed a partnership with IDEA that's gone for 8 years now.
Yeah, that's right.
There's a lot of these things that happen, but it's because of the way that we work, and we work across multiple things. And when you work on a condom, it's like, well, you need to do all these bits and pieces to actually get it to market.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about the condom? I mean, we're interested in the journey, but let's just talk a little bit about the condom. I know it's sort of, and I don't know what more you can talk about, but it's the first cab off the rank of a type of platform. And we've talked about some other applications for your technology, but let's just talk about the condom.
Yeah.
Whoever wants to have a crack at it. what's special about your condom, right?
Okay. It's so fundamentally, the nice thing about our device is it's kind of familiar with anyone who's listening, you know, or most people who've used one know what condoms are and what their limitations are. So fundamentally, condoms work. They are a medical device that, you know, prevents STIs and unplanned pregnancies.
It's the only medical device that
the
can
only
do
metal. Yeah, you're right.
Oh, that's true, actually. I never thought of it that way, right?
But it's also a consumer device, right? It's a consumer product that you choose to use or not based on how much it impacts the experience. And so there's all these things that the legacy materials kind of impact on. So if we think of things like smell or look or diminished feel or all these other things that are attributed known issues with current condoms. So the hydrogel platform alleviates a lot of these things from a user experience. So primarily it feels more like native skin, which is, that's the biggest thing. So whether there's a real or perceived lack of sensation, we can overcome that with a better feeling material. We could tune this material for that. It's also completely clear, no odors, no tastes, no allergies, all these other kind of aspects. We can use all different types of lubricants in it. So in terms of sexual experience, which is, you know, interrelated with pleasure, it ideally can provide a better sexual experience, safe sex experience. So replace latex, replace these legacy materials that have these limitations in the materials themselves, function very well as a device, but have these things where it's kind of a have to, and try to change that to, you know, I actually I want to put this on.
Yeah.
Or I really like when I use this because it gives me these benefits when I'm using them.
And it's funny, when you first told me that, I'm going, oh yeah, okay, sure.
Yeah.
And then you gave it to me in my hands, not I felt it between my fingers, and it was like, you could not tell the difference if there was something in your hands or not.
Awesome.
And you're doing this thing, hang on. I can see it there, but it doesn't feel like it's there. And that was really crazy. That was the moment I went, okay, these guys have got something.
It's one of the benefits of this.
What
materials.
Was that moment for you when you guys thought, oh, we've got something here. We really need to pretty much sort of put academia behind, focus on this. Cause that's a bit of a big step. We'll talk a little bit about
huge.
That. When was that moment for you guys?
Look, I could maybe comment on there's probably a professional level and a personal level. So from the company side, we were coming to the end of the funded work, and we had done quite a bit of engagement with large industry partners. This is a big industry. So there's, between 20 and 30 billion condoms made across the globe every year, and $11 billion in terms of where it is in legacy supply chains. And it's huge business.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they told us was, look, we're really interested, but you're not at the level where, you know, we don't want to deal with academia. We don't want to deal with all these issues that come across it. We're not looking to invest in R&D. We're looking to invest in products. So we knew that there was an endpoint that kind of where this could be taken on to that next level. We also realized that, look, and in reality, we don't buy products from universities. So there was a need to extract and to go beyond what we were doing. We did the work that we were commissioned to do, and what the Gates Foundation grant had funded us for to validate that this was possible. But there was a gap between our next work. And so it was also related to the end of the funding, and also needing to seek, obviously that's a lot of resourcing to move forward. So it was the right time we planned it, we knew it was coming. We planned for it, and we set an agenda to resource that well before we actually left. So it happened around the 2018 mark. It was phased, and then the company was formed, and we kicked off and capitalized, and we're going right from the beginning of 2019.
So from an academic perspective, I was like trying to be hardcore academia, like microbiology, biochemistry, working on these things, wanted to go on postdoc. And then you get drawn to this project that has very commercial outputs. And so one side, you want to stay in, we both had one foot in, one foot out at times. So essentially doing two part jobs, which equates to two full-time jobs. No job is ever part time. And so you're trying to push your academic career ahead. And, you know, I was doing quite well, but then you're competing against everyone that's publishing all the time and doing all their thing. And you need to be able to stay at that very high level in the field that you're in. And if you're trying to do something commercial, you can't really publish what you're doing. And so you're always in an academic sector. They talk about translation, but at a core, it's negatively impacting your career as an academic.
Because you can't publish, right?
Because you can't publish. And it's a publish or perish. They keep talking about blurred lines and like translation. I think we're probably a bit too early for that to come into reality. There were positions that have that in the future. But it was really, okay, well, I went part-time, Rob went part-time, I went part-time, and I put the other part-time into founding Udemon. And that's where I believed in the project very early on, actually, because most of the things that I wanted to do, and as an academic, was about achieving impact, like social good, not just impact in a broad sense. I wanted to do something that helped people. And when an opportunity like a condom came across.
Walking down a hallway.
It's these serendipitous moments where it's like, well, actually, when you think about it, this is exactly what I want to do. I want to have great like impact and help people. And so that's what drew me to take the risk, because really it was a gigantic risk to jump on this project. It had Gates funding, sure, but really it was going to negatively impact my academic career. Not to say that it actually did, because I went to Swinburne University and managed to work on a whole bunch of other projects and got a Fulbright scholarship out of it, which is one of the most like prestigious academic things you can get. But it was very challenging to do both. And so you have to what I'm saying to get to that point is like to leave academia and go and co-found a company and then decide to go fully into that, you have to be ready to believe in it and you have to be ready to take the risk.
Maybe just on that, because it just brings up things in my mind that people maybe don't realize, is the support network of family and friends around you to help you.
Exactly. Yeah.
What was that like for you guys? Was that for me in my career? It's been like I attribute everything to to those people who helped me and my family who supported me and told me to keep going when
that's
it
right.
didn't look very good.
Well, yeah.
So how was that for you guys? Was that
friends and family allow you to take that risk, right? Yeah. They support you.
Yeah.
Whether it's, you know, you're running out of money and they need money for a coffee at the end of the day or whatever, or just a pat on the back and encouragement. And no one ever runs home and says to their mum, oh, mum, I want to work on condoms.
Yeah.
Like, so for them, like even that kind of interaction is a bit of a change. And it's like for people to just be like, oh, that's cool and believe in you and say you can do it. It's really important and you need to have that support network. And
especially when you're sort of separating your two lives, right? You had this 1 foot in academia, 1 foot in something new, startup land.
Yeah, it's the people you work with as well. And like Rob and I are good friends, and it allows we argue.
That I want to get onto that in a second.
Yeah, if you want to answer the question,
just a couple of things on there. So, yeah, it's not. It was a huge risk, personal risk to go. It was also it's interrelated with a couple of the things that you've brought up. So, also, we'll get into the goals at one point, and yes, we've been very successful. And that is a part of dedicated hard work and execution.
Mm-hmm.
I want to also just mention, we're going in that, you know, one of the biggest things that I think we realized that it was real was when the Nick Northcott, who's our third co-founder, who's not here today, when he came on and originally was kind of a consultant for us, helping us drive this execution of transitioning from academia to like a startup. When he said, look, I want skin in the game. Mm. I believe in this. Mm. And he's an experienced executive. Mm. He used to help run Kids Telethon. He's very involved in the ecosystem.
Yep, yep.
And that was also more validation that we had others that were like, we want in. So that's and he's been a fundamental part from the beginning. So just wanted to mention that. In terms of also during that time, I remember times where I can remember 2 to 3 holiday periods, Christmases, where I didn't know if I had a job.
Yeah.
Coming into going from December into January. So academia at the moment was, even though we were kicking goals in the grants and everything else, we were doing massive things. We were one of the only ones that even got a Gates Foundation grant from the University of Wollongong. We were bringing in million plus. There was stress, massive stress that was in the background because those things were not secure going forward. Yeah. And also the goals that we were kicking at that point weren't necessarily reflected in terms of the academic setting, as Summer mentioned, in terms of that publishing and everything else.
It's challenging. I had 13 different contracts between 2014 and 2020. And we're getting grants where I said, we look successful, but really it's the stress of like trying to always validate what you're doing and explain what you're doing to someone else so they can make the decision to sign your next contract or try to find the money yourself. And that's one of the greatest challenges of academia and why it's so competitive, unfortunately.
And honestly, like in my case, taking that full step out, I had done a little bit of company. Well, I co-founded another company earlier in graphene and done some other work. So I had my feet wet to a point, but I had never fully stepped out. And this was, Eudemon was the first, you know, okay, I'm going to move away from this. And not too much further down in my career, but I had built a pathway, and if you're out, it's very, as someone said, it's very hard to get back in.
Mm, mm.
So the decision to go out was also very stressful and it took a lot to commit, but you know, being out, it took months and probably half a year to a year to feel comfortable with that decision. Mm. And if we weren't still kicking goals, I might be regretting that.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, it was the right thing to do at the time in retrospect, because we had the right team around us and because we had the right support. And when you say the friends, the family, everything else, you know, they'll always have your back. It's also, you know, I remember my partner saying, you know, you're happier. You look more content.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. You're probably more busier than ever, but you're more content than ever, right?
But it's control of your own destiny.
Yeah.
So this, like I mentioned, desperation from the beginning, part of it's because, you know, not being able, even though you want to do something, you know, that changes the world and you want to do something that also supports your family. You know, housing and kids and everything else that I deal with during that time. But you also just need that support in the background while you're doing it. So it's just an added complexity around that when you don't have that control and when you're running contract by contract or not knowing if you're going to have a job in the future. This was something that when we made it, we actively made a decision not only to create a company, but to create a supportive company. And we've done that not only just with the co-founders, but now with employees and whatnot. We fundamentally understand that. And you'll see a lot of, we'll call them ex-academics, but like those that have come up and they're in our role, they're in those positions and they thrive with us because we know, like, we get it. Let's do this. Let's do, you know.
Yeah, I think you have to be commended. I think the way that you did it was very staged and well thought out, but it still doesn't take away from the risks. And I can imagine.
And we were forced by the academics or by the universities that it was, you can't do this. They won't allow it inside. It's different now in certain, and certain universities are much better at actually translating and being supporting it from an internal perspective. But at that point, it was, look, if you want to do this, you're going to have to go out.
Yeah, I think that everyone's trying to find their feet and how to do that better, because I think there is a big opportunity for some of these technologies to make their way up, but there's always difficulties in doing it because they're essentially two different business models, right? Or one's about publishing, one's about...
Yeah, well, I remember when I said I wanted to go out and co-found a company, and the Pro Vice Chancellor for ICA commercialization at Swinburne at the time was like, are you sure you want to do that?
Yeah.
Like, it's a lot of work. And I was like, yeah, I'm sure.
Well, it's funny you say that because I have a chat set back in the office with some of the team, and I said, you know, because a lot of the people that want to work with us and what they also want to change the world, right? They want to do things better. Okay, you don't do that just rolling out of bed.
Yeah.
You know, you can't just rock up and it does take sacrifice in lots of different parameters, right? And especially if you're going to do it like what you're doing and then taking on a new company and starting that up, that's even it's even more than what you do within an organization, right? So
and there's lots of people that do want to do that and want to go every day and work on things that do change the world. And I think that's one of the things that in academia, there is a lot of really good islands of people that do really good, powerful things.
Yep.
In this case, there was no one responsible for taking it to the next step. We could have just killed it.
Yeah,
right? If it wasn't build something to bridge that next step, then the idea is going to die. It's just going to go. So part of that, I guess it's a bit of taking on the responsibility for it and the risk to see it go to that next level.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about the milestones and the goals that you've picked and what you want to do next.
That's a good segue from here, actually, because I think it's like, not to sound like martyrs that we're trying to do everything and survive and risk and all this, like it's complicated.
Yeah.
Academia is amazing and so is commercialization.
Yeah.
And
they're different, right?
They're different.
Yeah.
But what you also need from any career, I think, and this is my personal opinion, you need those milestones and validation to try to get to that impact that you're trying to make. And I think we were supported in the universities for sure, and we get rolled out to pitch a commercialization things or do that. And, you know, Swinburne was supportive of me going and doing the MedTech Actuator, which I pitched, and then we got the original $20,000 to fund the company.
Yep, I remember that. Yeah.
But at those times, it's really stressful. It's hard to do. I hadn't pitched before. Like, you know, it's all the training, the actuators. sure, when I have to be. But it's like you need that validation as well. And you don't know how important what you're doing is until you get that. You know, you win that $20,000 and you're like, oh, shit, like, we're doing it. Mm. And then we go and co-found the company, and then that's where it keeps growing and becomes successful. Gates Foundation, commercializing, founding the company.
So what have been some of those? What are some of the most significant ones that you can tell everyone about?
Yeah, we've been around, so as a company, we've been around for now four years.
In April 2018.
Yeah, and really, like, kicked off 2019 was really our real big year.
Mm-hmm.
So since what we've done is transitioned all of the things that we were doing in the university out or during that period of time. Mm-hmm. So we had a very rough prototype, and also working with IDE, we've gone through this next step. So it's probably good to just put in context the condom medical device development, right? So as in all medical devices, it's not an easy process. Oftentimes a decade or more with a whole bunch of regulation and requirements on top of it. And so even though we had some preliminary consumer validation, the next steps is really getting into production validation and then getting into that clinical approval, into clinical trials, into regulatory approval, into the market, right? So we've pushed from what was very early stage R&D into basically creating a production process.
That's right. Yeah.
Where, and a lot of the stuff we do with IDE in terms of creating almost an end-to-end automated condom production unit.
Yep.
All right. So we can take our bespoke materials, our new materials that have not been used in condom manufacture before, and we've, over a period of years, we've refined it to actually create a condom product that comes out. So, you know, it's not all fully automated, but you essentially have a rolled condom at the end that would be almost indistinguishable, except for that it looks very clear and feels better.
Meeting all the parameters and all the standards.
Well, I think
that was, so that's one part of it was just building the manufacturing side. Mm-hmm. The second thing was then taking those condoms and then consistently getting them independently validated that they can meet the parameters mm-hmm. and the specifications of what you've been saying. So condoms that go on the market, they need to be tested for quality. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times this is inflating them and looking for holes or making sure that the thicknesses have all been aligned in a batch of 100,000 or that testing that there's a biobarrier parameter. There's all these things that are done routinely for all the condoms that you buy. They take samples of the batches and do this. So we've, for a period of years, have showed that our production process and our new materials can create condoms that can be tested mm-hmm. and that can pass those verification standards. Mm-hmm. Beyond,
there's a little bit of serendipity in that part as well. When we were starting and you have these ISOs that you need to adhere to. Mm-hmm.
And
we
standards and
go on Google, like, you know, how do you make a condom? You get these ISOs and it's like, well, who does this testing? Oh, there's a company called Enosol and they're based in Annandale.
That's right.
We can literally drive up there and go and see John Durofi and be like, hey, how do we make a condom? He's like, here's the ISOs, this is what you need to do. And mm-hmm. that's part of the journey what Rob is telling us, because mm-hmm. it's a very clear pathway to market. Mm. You need to validate the aspects of manufacturing and the ISO tests and the regs and clinical, but you also have a very structured environment that you can operate in.
Mm.
And the serendipitous parts are that the world leader in condom quality assurance is an hour and a half away. Like, when does that ever happen?
Yeah.
Apparently happens.
Yeah.
Apparently
happens. But yeah, so as I said, the gold standard in that testing equipment is literally in our backyard and sells worldwide, but... And we were able to take our condoms, even preliminarily, and get them tested there. Mm-hmm.
Right? I was making them in the lab and driving them up in the car.
That's right.
But so over a period of years, we've validated our process to a level that is now basically at preclinical.
Interesting in terms of the space that you're in. So, you know, building a business is a challenge, period. Mm-hmm. But you're doing it in a space which hasn't had much innovation, dominated by a few massive players. So it's a pretty much a closed shop sort of situation for you guys. So to even have a prospect of probably making a market or making something at the end, and you're only as good as your last game, so you've got to keep on kicking goals. Mm-hmm. You have to sort of convince some of these players or take them on or something like that to get out there. What were the unique challenges, and conversely, what's your unique advantage in actually being able to tackle? Because that's I think some people, you know, people talk about the challenges, but there's something unique about the way that you guys are going about, the way that you have that has allowed you to make some progress.
Maybe some of the challenges first.
Yeah.
So, because there's a lot of medical devices, there's a lot of med tech. I mean, you know, everyone's talking about it, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, yes, there are I think it's underappreciated that, you know, a medical device could take 10 to 20 years to get into the market and tens to hundreds of millions to get through all of the things that are necessary to even make money. Mm. Like, and drugs are even more when you're talking pharmaceuticals. Mm. So this is not... In that space, it takes a risk appetite, which we know in Australia, there's only a limited amount, not only of appetite, but even capacity to fund this stuff. Capital. So that's a limitation that we all have, but we had it as well. We were, as you mentioned, probably even more limited in, we went to investment firms and we did pitches at different things and like, it's condoms.
Yeah.
And it's like, this isn't an exciting new cancer drug.
It's not AI in it or something.
No, it's not anything. For better or worse, most of the people that came back were like, look, this is really interesting. What you're doing is really interesting. It just doesn't fit into our portfolio of investments. So we had on one side, you have the medical device pressures. You also have this, call it a deficit from the investment appetite and portfolio kind of networks in Australia and worldwide, as well as this is a legacy device, you know, essentially undifferentiated for the last couple decades, besides some minor material modifications and lubricants, and which is controlled, particularly the markets, by two or three major players in the on-the-shelf kind of side. Mm-hmm. And the lowest price kind of distributors in the public health side.
Mm-hmm.
So very very limited in terms of where are those next on-take partners, right? So it was even further on us to prove not only would people like this and like this more, like enough that it's justifying the investment to move this forward, but also that it had, you know, a potential cost advantage or manufacturing benefit or supply chain ease or whatnot. So what we've built, and this is where we talk about the platform, we're disconnecting from the usual Southeast Asian supply chains that are basically around latex production.
Around the
raw material source.
Raw materials, yeah. Right?
Massive, you know, not only environmental and cost bits, but also huge labor costs involved.
Logistics.
Yeah, manual labor is involved. There's and timings, everything else. It's an old school industry.
Mm. Climate change is changing the access of the latex.
It's commodity markets, everything. So we're disconnecting by being able to, our uniqueness and what we've always kind of positioned is using kind of a synthetic but a good material that can not only improve the consumer experience but also have advantages for the producer. So overcome the need or be resilient to the need of supply, automate quite a bit of the manufacturing, improve the quality that comes out and the safety as well. And that's what we've done in terms of our units is kind of make them mobile or at least offer that potential to make them.
Decentralize at least, right?
Decentralize.
If we're changing the material, why not change everything essentially? Yeah, like you upscale everything, put automation. You talk about AI and not being in it, but it actually is. It can be.
Well, in the automation. Yeah, I agree. I agree. Probably misspoke there. Forgot about that bit. But the investors wouldn't have known that.
We didn't know that at the time until we start getting into the digital. You put a robot in that it opens up the digital aspects and you can see how you can improve all of those things.
Yeah. But you're sort of, just to double down on that, I think one of the things that you're doing is something that we always preach is, right, you try to find value along the key stakeholders, but the people that matter in decision making. You need to satisfy all of them, not just have a great experience for the user.
Yeah.
You have to actually make it worthwhile for these bigger players who may be your distributors, your future manufacturers. So you can't just do it, you know, myopically, and people always think that, oh, look, I've got this great thing, these people are going to love it. But what about all the other people in the chain that have to love it or have a benefit out of it to make it actually a reality?
And control it
at
the moment. I mean, this is one of the things of also we're talking, and this is probably one of the benefits of, so maybe that's some of our uniqueness. Why is the condom space so lucrative? It's also so ripe for disruption.
No one's been
able to crack it for decades. It is a huge market. You know, condoms are used on every single continent. It is one of the most widely known and understood devices and promoted devices, and it's a fundamental tool that's used in not only safe sex but family planning and everything else. So there is a massive opportunity to disrupt those kind of the status quo of what's on the shelves. And, you know, the brands and others are really looking for, you know, how are we going to push this in one market versus another market? This is another thing that if you can decentralize or at least disconnect from that need for massive, massive infrastructure in one place that's controlled locally by raw material support, you can enter markets differently and more easily and do that in a way. There are certain regulation which requires you to do manufacturing in different places to even get in the market. So you're offering all these aspects. The other thing is that we've always thought about this as it's not one condom. It is a platform of future condoms. The MVP, like latex and some of the other materials, are at the end of their life span in terms of what you can do with it. A balloon is a balloon is a balloon. There are certain small things that can still be done, but fundamentally, it's been exploited to its max. We've just scratched the surface. We've just began to even explore different field types, compound loading behaviors, all sorts of things. There is, we have a list of probably 30 to 50 other condoms that we can make on top of our platform. So it is a product pipeline that if we get it right in this rapid manufacturing to clinical aspect, which is aided by Industry 4.0, aided by all these other processes that we're innovating on, then it's not just the first one that we can do, but it's going to be the next one and the next one. And that really goes to not only show the potential value in condoms themselves, but take out, you know, a former that's a condom and put it in for another device, and now you have a platform that's much broader. So we are focused on condoms. It is a very lucrative market. It is a driver for where we want to go. But are we not, we're not keeping ourselves blind to those other opportunities in the future. If we can get all the way through clinical into market, we've validated that our process could work. So it's always in the back of our mind. We're kind of having to swat down all these other ideas and say, stay focused.
And that's one of the biggest challenges. You see all these massive opportunities in different spaces, in manufacturing and different materials and products. And we've, you know, we've done that in times. But we realize you really need to focus on that. And the, in reality, what we're building is a case, using the condom as a case study to demonstrate what we're doing can be impactful. And not just the condom, but the process and the system. So that engine, if you want to call it that.
We're probably going to start to wrap up now. We've been enjoying our conversation a lot. Just a couple of points here. The two of you, or the three of you with Nick, we talk about collaboration with us and with others. You talked about some of the other partners. How does that work? How have you guys made it work? How do you see collaboration in general? Can you talk a little bit about that?
I see the value in just multidisciplinary work and collaboration in all aspects of what we do in life, really. You need to have those inputs to come in and change your view on something and be challenged at all times. And that's what we do. We challenge each other a lot. But that's the point. It's like it needs to be everyone that you work with, you need to be able to have those conversations and be able to come out of it at the end and say, okay, this is what we're doing. This is the right thing, and believe in that. Going back to earlier in the conversation, talking about building those multidisciplinary teams, that's where you get challenged. That's where new ideas come in. You know, we're not all the same people. We all have different ideas, and that's the power of the company. And it's not just the three of us. It's all the people that we interact with in those teams that put inputs into what we do. And so, you know, it sounds all happy clappy, but that's a reality. Yeah. It is like it's always taking all these different aspects and diverging from that core of academia, which is something you focus and go deep and deep and deeper. When you try to be successful in this space, you need to be more divergent with your thinking, and that's the power of
I like how you said challenge, and we're big proponents. I'm big proponents of that, and criticism, and but constructive criticism, right? But that's really what, you know, because for me, you know, ideas are a dime a dozen. Everyone's got great ideas, right? But coming up with the really impactful ones, the meaningful ones, you actually have to criticize, and you have to be open to it. You have to challenge. A good partner for us is someone who's going to say, mate, I know you want to do this, but have you thought about this? Because it's not in your interest to do what you want.
Yeah, we get challenged by idea all the time.
It's interesting. I think that's a bit of a synergy, right? That we all like to challenge each other and criticize each other at times.
I'll just add to that, look, and Simon touched on this beginning, from the onset of the work, we've always embraced a multidisciplinary approach. Yeah. We weren't just looking at, you know, coming from a mechanical or engineering side. We knew that that was not, it was only one part of the solution to a consumer product. You know, we had people, user engagement researchers with us from the beginning, neuroscience people, these things. So it was fundamental then. It's just as fundamental now. I think we approach strategically from the company in terms of collaboration. If we don't have the expertise inside, we look to who's the best. Who can we get and outsource with, and who we can work with to, you know, tactfully execute. And you're one of the of our biggest partners in that, in terms of, you know, we basically rely and work with you guys on, you know, keeping that 1345 compliance for our stuff, because it's so critical. People like Enersol or others, we work with them on quality assurance. We do, that goes across also IP, it goes across legal, it goes across every single part. So, and at one point it becomes a trigger of how much, when it does come to a point where we need it internal, then we build it and we bring that in. But we very much are, we run leanly, even though we work with consultants with a deep expertise on that. So I think you guys mentioned, it's not always easy. It takes, even we've evolved the our relationship as the needs have changed. And sometimes it's just not clear. And I think we've done that very successfully, or we wouldn't be talking.
Yeah, but communicating. You guys also evolve as well, right? You guys have changed a lot in over the past few years in terms of how you see things. That's what I've noticed, and how you go about things.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Like, I've changed completely. Like, it's part and parcel of what we do. It's just like you need to keep building it, taking those inputs and keep considering them and going on. And I think one of our greatest strengths is that we communicate quite well and try to communicate and build a culture which people believe in us. You know, we have a no assholes policy. That's the reason why we've worked with IDE for so long.
Just on that, two things, right? Like you just said, we go external for the expertise that we don't have and go to the best and just get it in as quickly as possible. And that no asshole policy is actually, it's fundamental, because we drain you. It'll drain not the only energy, the work, and you will not get to the end point. So finding people you can work with and that you like to work with it is a process. It is so fundamental to also our success. So we also think, I would say, you know, it's part and thanks to you guys that we're in the place where we are now and the rest because we were able to find that. Yeah. So even going back to that first...
We're always grateful for the continued confidence and always need to support each other. Maybe just to wrap up on the final question, I have been enjoying this. We could just keep on going, but I know we can't keep on going.
If you buy beers, we'll stay around.
Yeah, it's on Friday. Friday, you know.
Yeah, you know.
We know that.
Yeah. Too bad it's not Friday. Tomorrow. I guess just wanted to, like, for people listening, I think there's a lot to take from what you guys have said. I've really enjoyed listening to it. But maybe, you know, this move from, because I'm sure there's lots of other academics or people doing research wanting to have a toe in the water or try something like this. Any advice, maybe each of you maybe give a bit of advice of what to do and what not to do, or what would you have liked to have known when you started out that you know now? Because like I said, you've evolved quite a lot and I'm very proud of what you guys have done. We can end up on that.
Thanks, Richard. Yeah, it's hard to answer because even when we're having discussions like this, I feel very scattered because there's so many different things you can talk about. You can talk about any multitudes of things. I think the advice that I would just give anyone is just think about what you want to do and how difficult everything is and make sure you're passionate about it and believe in it. And if you believe in it and you can drive it and you can take the risk on, eventually you'll go somewhere and someone will say you're doing a good job and they'll validate you. You'll get a grant success or you'll work with a great partner like RDE and you keep getting those small pats on the back, which make you be able to continue and work in those things. That can happen in academia. It's a different ecosystem. It's a bit more challenging. It's a bit more competitive. I think for me, that shift is, as long as you believe in it, stay in academia, that's sure. But if you have this idea and you think you can drive it and you think you are the person to drive it, then you need to make your startup company to be able to translate that because you can't be dictated to essentially because you need to drive the culture, you need to drive the idea, you need to drive it to where it needs to go. And so the only advice I can really give is be passionate and make that tough choice very early on. I said that we stayed one foot in, one foot out. If I went back, I would probably just get out earlier and just if I could get the funding and get some resources and just commit earlier, I would. But you know, it's all serendipity and the way that we went through it worked out and you know, keeping those close ties to academia and everything's very beneficial for us. So,
fantastic. Rob?
Yeah, tough one. Particularly because the ecosystem of academia is so different even now than it was 2 years ago. As I said, post the purge and even before then. I think I might go back to my first comment about desperation that, you know, maybe it's embracing that or accepting that there is always going to be this risk and stress, particularly there are unique aspects of that in academia. And to, as Simon said, you know, if you see an opportunity, which kind of comes, a lot of times it comes from desperation or in times of desperation, if you're ready to, if you take it, it can be very beneficial and you will learn from it. And it may not be that you're going to be successful in the first thing because most people normally aren't, and I certainly haven't been, but it may be the next thing or the next thing that happens and those doors will keep opening. I also echo, I look back and say, look, I try not to look back like I wasted time. I don't believe I did, but I would encourage my earlier self to get that toe out earlier and see what's happening in industry and in the startup ecosystem particularly as well, just to be aware of how to translate those ideas. And to have that, if you have that kind of exposure, you can build then a lens while you're inside, while you're still doing things in academia, whether you stay or not. And I think you can go back and forth now with more opportunities. But as long as you keep moving forward with it, but having that lens of what happens outside will also allow you to identify these opportunities and exploit them better internally. So I think that would be one thing. The other thing I would say is you need to take care of your mental health. I definitely have struggled, particularly through the whole thing, like my whole career. The universities are not supportive. They're supportive as much as they can. They are big organizations.
Definitely big organizations.
Like, find organizations that also fit that no asshole policy personally and that you want to work for and that you feel supportive. And if they're not, you need to start thinking about, is that the right fit? Because I think again, that desperation, you can go both ways. You can kind of get more entrenched, or you can go out and try to find
something else.
Yeah, and doing it in a smart way. So it is possible. There are a lot of opportunities, and it's just making sure to keep an eye on yourself.
Yeah, sure. I think you've made that transition quite. I think you've been able to leverage all the best aspects of academia and all the best aspects of startup and government support as well. So I think without all of those three pillars, you probably wouldn't be where you are now. So there's great, I think, a gratitude that you guys have for all that. And even though there's difficulties in all of that,
absolutely.
I've seen it firsthand. So thanks, guys. I wanted to wish you guys obviously all the very best personally and professionally, and
thanks,
you know, keep kicking goals, you know. And I always say, as good as your last game, you got to keep going. You know?
That's right.
You never know what happens, but I think you've done a fantastic job. And to Nick as well, who's listening, and to the others in the team. Yeah, and thank you for taking the time to share this. I think everyone should get enjoyment out of listening to your story, and hopefully some inspiration and some ideas. And we'll see you on Friday for beers. But otherwise, thank you very much, everyone. Yeah.
No worries. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Cheers.